Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And I am really delighted to have a guest on from a part of the world that is not the easiest place for me to get live guests on because of the big, big time difference. I'm talking about East Asia, specifically South Korea. And my guest is George Katsiafikas. George is a visiting American professor of humanities and sociology at Cheonam National University in Gwangju, hope I'm pronouncing that right, Gwangju, South Korea, where he teaches and he does research on the 1980s and 1990s East Asian uprisings. He's also a Fulbright Fellow, a longtime activist, and the author of numerous books, including Imagination of the New Left, The Global Analysis of 1968. Oh, I remember 1968 so well. What we want to talk about mainly is rising South Korean right-wing extremism, given the new administration, or the current administration, and also tensions over North Korea. And very briefly, I'd just like to start out with an overnight event for us here in the West. In case listeners haven't heard the morning news, I heard about it. I didn't listen to the morning news, but I imagine it was pretty strongly headlined. There was a bombing in Jakarta, Indonesia, in two luxury hotels. A number of people were killed. Many more were wounded. And, of course, they blame the usual suspects. But who knows? We'll know more later. And the alternative media will give you much better information on this than you'll ever get through the dominant media. In the past, we've seen events like this that were blamed on quote-unquote terrorists, and it turned out that the fingerprints of state-sponsored activities were all over this. Back last November in Mumbai, India, that very much appears to have been the case, but of course, the usual suspects over there were blamed for it. Certainly can't say that so far in the Jakarta incident, but who knows? George, I welcome you warmly to the program where it's midnight your time.
That's right, Steve. It is indeed.
Oh,
thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so delighted to have you on. You're a lot tougher than I am. I don't know what shape I would be in to do an interview at midnight.
Well, midnight is not so late, actually, but, it depends on your waking hours.
So, I get up extremely early in the morning. I like to tell people that I wake the chickens. Somebody has to do it, so I'm the guy.
All right.
But yeah. I am delighted to have you on. We have a few commercial breaks. You'll hear soft music come on, George, and then I'll interrupt and we'll move on. But what is your take? How is the media where you are, or in the general environs, talking about the Jakarta incident?
Well, of course it's big news here. CNN International, which we get in our living room, to me it's a rather, disgusting portrayal of how the coverage is so biased, because what they've been doing is showing kitchen areas and other areas of the hotel and the extensive damage, not focusing at all on the victims. And of course, when it comes to coverage of Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, there's no coverage at all of the human suffering that goes on. So it's the question is these hotels and the property that's been destroyed that has been played up both on CNN and in other stations here.
The commercial side, George, we need to take a break. And of course, CNN International, it's pretty bad, but it's a lot better than the local domestic version here, as I'm sure you know.
That's right. Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
It is really about the bottom of the barrel of business.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with George Katsiafikas from South Korea. George, it really is shocking and shameful that all through the 1990s and in Iraq And after 2001, October 2001, Afghanistan, March 2003, Iraq, the human side of those conflicts were literally airbrushed out of the news. And we're talking about many millions of people either killed, wounded, displaced, and deprived of the critical essentials to maintain life and well-being. Not a story.
That's right, Stephen. And really, that's, if you look at the history of United States involvement in East Asia, going back for a century, that's the way that the story has been written, is in terms of U.S. glory, U.S. sacrifice, and the millions of people who have been killed, just not discussed. If we go, for instance, to the U.S. conquest of the Philippines at the end of the Spanish-American War, hundreds of thousands of Filipinos were massacred by U.S. troops. Not known. Filipinos don't want to dwell on it. Americans certainly don't want to even know about it. Don't know about it. If we go to more recent history, in, for instance, the Korean War, the latest numbers are, and that you have to remember, in Korea, there were decades of military dictatorships in the South, during which it was impossible to really discuss the casualties of the war. It was a forbidden subject. If you tried to do that, you were considered a communist and imprisoned, or worse. So there was a window of time, 10 years of progressive administration, during which numbers started to emerge, and the numbers say that something like 5 million Koreans out of a population of less than 40 million total, North and South, perished in that three-year war. That's a remarkably high number that Americans have no consciousness of. And if you realize then that, you know, the history continues, that our media and our government's unwillingness, inability to deal with these numbers leads then to the next conflict in Vietnam and Indochina, where something like 3 million people are sacrificed on the altar of democratic intervention, so-called democratic intervention. And then, of course, we go into the current situation. I mean, I'm skipping over interventions in Central America. And, you know, I think your listeners by now must be aware of all this. But to the current conflicts that are, you know, Obama administration has actually, in my view, has extended the war. It's made 2 million or so new people homeless and to refugees in Pakistan. So we're still fighting a war in Iraq. You know, it's a U.S.-sponsored war. Whether the soldiers in the American-made uniforms are Iraqi or American, whether he's changed the color of the corpses, as Nixon called it, in Vietnam when he so-called Vietnamized the war, you know, Afghanistan is now a bigger war. Iraq is happening, and now the war has been extended into Pakistan. So it's almost as if the U.S. administration is making the entire region from Palestine, Israel, all the way across the Islamic world, you know, into Pakistan, Afghanistan, into a kill zone, a free fire zone, where drones have become the weapon of choice. And CNN International is running sensationalist stories about the elegance of this type of warfare and appealing to American young people who love to play video games as a means, you know, of recruitment. And it's really a situation that I don't know how, in fact, it's going to come to an end, because it appears that the heavy weight of the American empire is causing the economy to crash. You know, all of the talk of the subprime mortgage crisis, the financial crisis, as that I have been privy to and that I have seen in the media, doesn't really talk about the fact that the administration has been spending hundreds of billions of dollars annually on these wars.
George, and the combination of militarism and the latest defense budget, I don't think it's, you know, I'm not certain if it passed or not, but it will pass. But I know the last time I read a brief report on it, it was proposed the largest defense budget in U.S. history, and I've said on this program often enough, bigger if you include all categories, not the headline number, all categories, It amounts to more than the rest of the world combined.
That's right.
And, of course, the U.S. has no enemy anywhere. It's had no enemy anywhere since the end of World War II. And yet we spent all this money. I once saw a figure, an estimate, and I think it was up to, a number of years back. I forget exactly when, maybe around the mid-1990s or so, that we had spent somewhere on the order of $30 trillion on the military. And I forget if that was inflation adjusted or not. But, I mean, we're talking about numbers that are incomprehensible. So we're directing all this money to militarism for nothing. And, of course, since the economic crisis that became a global one because of the stuff that went on here in the U.S., we've poured many, many trillions of dollars literally down a rat hole to these banks, these giant banks, responsible for causing this crisis in the first place, while at the same time fixing the economy has gone begging, so it's not happening.
Well, I think, unfortunately, the world economic system, as it's currently constructed, requires warfare for the system to function at all. It requires militarism and warfare. It's not the choice of a few individuals, you know, that we have wars. It's a systematic product of the capitalist relations, the need for giant corporations to continue to make profits. And if you think about it just somewhat logically, as the Club of Rome did some decades ago, MIT computer engineers and some of the richest industrialists in the world commissioned a study, and it you know, the limits to growth, and it basically said, as long as you have a finite planet and infinite needs for profits, increasing profits annually on the part of big corporations, which after all is how the system is constructed, you've got to have a way for these profits to be generated. And warfare is that way in the present constellation of economic forces. So if it taints everything. You know, one of the questions facing people in Korea daily is this notion that there could be a new Korean War in which millions of people would die. And if you look logically at what has happened to the Obama presidency, he came into office promising to negotiate with everyone, including North Korea. He explicitly had said that. And yet he's refused to do that. Why, should we ask? Why has Obama refused to do that? After all, he, you know, has engaged all these other parties around. He's willing to talk, this and that, but not North Korea. Well, I think there's a very simple answer to it, but I think it makes a lot of sense, and it's not discussed in the media, and that is, it's the best way to sell these hugely expensive missile defense systems that the administration is pushing in South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan, nations that are holding hundreds of billions of dollars in debts to the U.S. How better to get that money back into the U.S., back into circulation than to sell? For instance, if I could just give you a few statistics here, Japan has already modified four Aegis ships with interceptive missiles. It's already put into use three new PAC-3 missile systems with 12 fire units, Patriot missile systems. It's upgraded its sensors. It's developed new tactical data distribution systems and upgraded existing ones and linked these all to satellites. South Korea is, again, using its two satellites and its Global Hawk high-altitude systems to detect signs of North Korea missile launches. It's already got those into place. And it's implemented new PAC-3 missile systems and is buying new missile defense systems from the United States. Taiwan as well is under threat here. So this is a hugely profitable way to, by playing up the North Korea threat, it's a great way for the Obama administration to try to help solve his number one problem right now, which is the economy. I would predict, if my theory is correct, that if come his time to run for re-election, he will make a move to negotiate with North Korea. But until then, he's got several years in which to sell these systems. And he's going to use that time period I think he's going to milk it to sell as many of the systems as we can. And let's hope that in that intervening period, there is not the outbreak of a major war. It seems very likely to people here, many people that I've spoken with, that the new conservative administration in South Korea wants a small war of some kind for their own domestic policy agenda, to increase their own military budget, to silence the insurgent forces that are against the change in policy from what had been 10 years of progressive administrations and what we call the Sunshine Policy, of essentially détente between North and South Korea. You know, those are slowly being undone. And it appears that in the West Sea here, there's going to be some kind of a naval engagement in the next month or two.
Well, that is very disturbing to hear, George. I had no idea that the administration, I guess the Lee administration, might literally want to instigate some kind of a conflict, because a little one can suddenly spiral out of control and be a big one. I have a question for you, and correct, we'll get a break, but you can answer when we come back. My understanding, and I may be wrong, is that going back a good many years, North Korea has wanted rapprochement with the West, but the West has spurned the government of North Korea, so it's never happened. But let's take a break and come back, and I'd love to hear your answer to that.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with George Katsiofikas from South Korea. George, is there any truth to my assumption that North Korea really has wanted a good relations with South Korea and the West?
Well, I think with the West, certainly. You know, I think what we need to understand about North Korea is that they were completely destroyed in the Korean War. There was not one major building in the northern part of the country left standing after U.S. bombing had thoroughly destroyed the place. And
we ran out of targets to bomb, George. That was my understanding.
Yeah, and not only did we run out of targets, but then we used Japanese manufactured germ warfare against the North in the final months of the war. I was in North Korea. I saw bomblets that were preserved in their museum that had clear markings of made in the USA. I spoke with witnesses who had seen these bomblets dropped. I saw, you know, and the evidence that now there have been two university press books published about U.S. biological warfare against Korea at the end of the Korean War. So it's not that it's not known, but it's never really been covered in the media. So we not only bombed the country, we bombed cities, we bombed dikes and dams and flooded area, killing, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in certain moments. There were horrific massacres. In fact, when I toured some of the massacre sites, my bus buddy was from Vietnam, Vietnamese, and he and I, after visiting a particularly grisly site in Shincheon, both were sitting in the bus kind of dumbfounded, and I, as we drove back to the hotel, I asked him, well, you know, how do you feel about this when you compare this with Vietnam? And he looked at me and he said, we had, you know, several My Lais, the massacres there in Vietnam, but North Korea had dozens or even hundreds of them. This was a much bloodier war than the Vietnam War. So
it was just much more concise, George. I remember so well, because I finished high school in June of 1952, and you could be exempted from being drafted if you continued your schooling. So, of course, I did, and I can remember so clearly as a freshman a lot of talk among my friends went along the lines. We, as a freshman, you're always acclimating to a new academic environment, high school to college. And the thing that we stressed so much was We have to be sure to keep our grades up. And the line that we use was, so we don't end up in the frozen chosen, the chosen reservoir that was not the most pleasant place in the wintertime.
And, it, you know, the MacArthur's arrogance and his belief that the U.S. could actually win a war by just wholesale massacre of people, it was so wrong. It sacrificed not only Koreans, also American troops who were sent all the way up into the North, into a trap. I mean, the North Koreans basically, you know, prepared the ground so that when the Americans drove up to the Yalu, there was no place for them to retreat. They were surrounded, in fact. So,
and MacArthur wanted to use nuclear weapons, too.
Sure.
Truman turned them down.
Right. The thing about North Korea is, of course, they want one thing from the U.S., and that is a formal treaty of peace. That war ended with a ceasefire, with an armistice, and an armistice line that is still, to this day, maintained at the 38th parallel. They want a full-on peace treaty. They want the Senate of the United States to vote a peace treaty. And, you know, it's just, I don't know. Let's say, for instance, they have said they will give up their missile programs and their nuclear programs if the U.S. Senate will sign a peace treaty, will sign a formal treaty of peace with North Korea, exchange ambassadors. Of course, everything that goes with that, they would then be part of the IMF, World Bank, WTO. They want into the world system of finance. You know, they have no capacity to get loans of major nature now anywhere in the world except from China, except from their allies. And they want into the international system. And they have read the lessons of Iraq that Saddam Hussein disarmed. He didn't have weapons of mass destruction, as we know. And then the U.S. invaded and overthrew him, captured him. So the U.S. is saying, we won't sign a peace treaty with you until you disarm. And they're saying, we won't disarm until we have a peace treaty. Now, let me ask you logically, why wouldn't the U.S. sign a peace treaty with North Korea? If indeed the United, again, it's a logical question. Why won't we sign a peace treaty? In my opinion, it's because the North Korea threat, hyped up as it is a way to sell U.S. weapons systems.
Oh, no question. No, so, we need enemies, George.
Absolutely. We manufacture them.
When the Soviet Union dissolved in 1990, I think the feeling of the U.S. was a feeling of terror. My God, you know, the evil empire doesn't exist anymore. What are we going to do? We need a new evil empire.
Well, unfortunately, the U.S. not only has so-called Islamic fundamentalism as its enemy today, but it's also surrounding China. It's building up its bases and creating an enemy out of China. A long-run enemy. The alliance is fragile, but it's, you know, you began this segment by talking about Indonesia.
George, we need to break.
Okay.
We'll pick up as soon as we get back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
To the News Hour, on with George Katsiafikas from South Korea. Oh, George, there's no question the topic you got into before the break, encircling China and also Russia. Russia, the only country in the world that's a military rival of the U.S., and China, a very growing economic rival. And there's no question that both of them are very concerned and not at all happy about this.
Right. I mean, you know, the segue here was you began talking about Indonesia. In China, I was recently in China for 3 weeks. In fact, I was in Xinjiang, in Urumqi, the day before the riots there broke out. And I was lucky because I wasn't there for, you know, this horrific event. And yet I spent a week and really, you know, met wonderful people, hospitable people, spent time with families and singing east and saw stunningly beautiful scenery. And yet, when this horrific event happened and the reports in China and the reports that I was able to get by calling people, it had a very strong element of ethnic conflict. You know, the Han Chinese were colonizing the area, moving into the area, and there was a lot of resentment from the Turkish, the Uyghur locals. But what happened afterwards was that the Chinese army came in and killed many Uyghurs, and it wasn't reported anywhere in the media. It just, you know, what the Chinese government did was cut off the internet, cut off cell phones. I believe the internet is still cut off for all of Xinjiang. But Al-Qaeda heard about it through their networks and released a statement saying that they were going to retaliate for the killing of the Uyghurs. I think it's no accident that those bombings in Indonesia happened. After all, many Chinese business people stay in those very hotels that were bombed. So I think there's an element of retaliation for the massacre of Uyghurs in Xinjiang behind the bombings in Indonesia.
Well, that could very well be, George. Just one other thought in my mind, and again, it goes back to state sponsorship, such as what I believe was the case in Mumbai, India, in November last year. The U.S. Has instigated trouble around the world, and they certainly did it to China when the Tibetan monks were swarming in protest. And U.S. fingerprints were all over that activity, and numerous other incidents, the same thing, U.S. fingerprints on them. So I don't know, but I have strong suspicions that whatever else was going on, it could be that U.S. fingerprints were on the unrest in I guess, Western China.
Well, certainly there, you know, that's the Chinese government's position, is that the Uyghur parliament in exile, the government in exile in Munich, Germany, had something to do through emails with the uprising that occurred in Urumqi, in Kashgar, in other cities. It's hard to say, but clearly the U.S. military presence in that region, in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and other places, is growing. And I don't know that we can find a fingerprint on the uprising, because it seems to me, for instance, Uyghur women who were wearing short sleeve shirts or skirts were also targeted by the basically fundamentalist Islamic knife wielding attackers in that riot on July 5th. So there was the ethnic element to it, but it also appeared, you know, it's a very, Urumqi is a very tough area in some ways. So it appears that there was the element of ethnic conflict that was fanned by the flames of Islamic fundamentalism. I don't know, Stephen.
Oh, we don't know. We're not on the inside. But, of course, what we do know is that since it came into existence, the CIA has instigated covert mischief against one country after another. William Blum wrote a book about it. I mean, he wrote a book, and then he updated it, and it's a good-sized book, just covering all of the mischief that the CIA has done, directly coups, assassinating leaders, I mean, all kinds of stuff going on, plus the so-called independent agencies that a U.S. government funded, like the National Endowment for Democracy and the International Republican Institute and others, that pour millions of dollars into regions to destabilize them, areas or countries that are not in the U.S. orbit or the way we want them to be, so the post-election street violence and protests that went on in Iran, George,
I absolutely
believe that U.S. fingerprints were all over that.
Stephen, on that particular. And, you know, we've seen it already in places like Georgia as well, where, you know, the CIA has very well understood this new dynamic of people going into the streets, being able to change government. And, you know, some of the ways in which they were able to prepare that surprised all of us who believed that this tactic had some purity to it. But, you know, I think I've been looking at these Asian uprisings, and much as, for instance, the Philippines 1986 People Power Uprising has been glorified by pacifists all over the world, I recently was there. I met with Gringo Honestan, who's now a senator, but who was one of the military leaders of the mutiny in the military that sparked the EDSA revolution of 1986 that overthrew Marcos. And the fact is that the leaders of the military mutiny had a direct line with CIA during the entire uprising. We know this now from new books that were published in 2006 in the Philippines. And I was astonished when I read them, but it made total sense. That they, for instance, were even given intelligence on what Marcos's army's movements were so that they were able to defend themselves against. The U.S. basically believed that Marcos, because of his corruption and cronyism, had become an obstacle in the war against the guerrilla movement in the Philippines. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff had come to the conclusion that Marcos had to be ousted.
No question.
So,
no question.
You know, that pure so-called people power revolution is from the very beginning then tainted with CIA involvement. I mean, Filipino activists love to say, you know, some people see in the people power movement the hand of the CIA. Other people see in it the hand of God, the heavy involvement of the church, and the miracle of its not having ended in a bloodbath. And, of course, they say, but, you know, we see the power of the people. And all of those elements are present. All of those elements are present.
And the same the same thing has happened, George, in other countries around the world. The Congo comes to mind, Democratic Republic, not so Democratic Republic of the Congo. Mobutu, after many, many years, outlived his usefulness, so we got rid of the guy. It turned out that we put the wrong guy in. He didn't knuckle under to the U.S., so we murdered him. And we put another Laurent Kabila. And we put another guy in by the name of Kabila, who's supposedly his son, but apparently he's not his son. and I don't think he's coming under the U.S. Orbit the way we want. So if he mysteriously dies in an unfortunate plane crash, we'll know that the CIA rigged it to have the plane crash, or maybe a missile would shoot it down or something. And this goes on over and over again. George, can I?
Sure. I mean, if you look at Panama, Manuel Noriega is now
absolutely
in a Florida prison. If you look
absolutely
at Vietnam, you know, we got rid of Diem, the Diem brothers who were running the country when Kennedy was president.
Oh, under Kennedy.
3 weeks before Kennedy was killed, Diem was assassinated by his own general.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's when Malcolm X made his famous speech, right? The chickens are coming home to roost. He had understood. Even before the CIA reports and all of the classified documents were released, Malcolm X said, "This is the U.S. is behind the assassination of Diem."
Oh, absolutely, George.
So,
can we focus? I don't want to run out of time without talking about South Korea.
Sure.
We talked a little bit about North Korea. Explain the difference between the Sunshine Period and the Lee government now. That really, I guess, is brutally repressive, because I don't think listeners know about that, and they need to.
Okay. Basically, after the Korean War, there were almost four decades of military dictatorships in South Korea. There were small periods in 1960 when Syngman Rhee was overthrown by a student revolution, and for nearly a year there was a democratic government. But basically, South Korea was ruled by military dictators. And there were uprisings in Gwangju, this city where I am, in 1980. Remarkable uprising. Hundreds of people were killed by the military. But the people basically governed themselves for most of a week through direct democracy. They had driven the military out of the city, but they were overwhelmed by military force supported by the U.S. 1987, 7 years later, there were 19 consecutive days of illegal demonstrations involving hundreds of thousands of people. and people made a tremendous breakthrough. They won the right for direct presidential election. They didn't reap the fruit of that for some years to come. But there were 10 years of very progressive administrations beginning in 1997. Kim Dae-jung, who went on to win a Nobel Peace Prize, initiated the Sunshine Policy by going to Pyongyang and meeting with Kim Jong-il, the leader of North Korea. And they did very simple steps. You know, the Asian patients, the legendary Asian patients, they permitted family visits of family members who had not been able to visit each other for nearly half a century. They opened a new rail line for freight between North and South Korea. They opened a tourist resort in North Korea that brought in South Korean tourists. Hyundai Corporation basically did the financing. They opened under Kim Dae-jung and his successor, No Moo-hyun. They opened a joint industrial park, North Korean laborers, South Korean capital, in Kaesong, in North Korea. And, you know, they were making step-by-step progress in reunifying the country. Something like, polls show something like 85% of the people of South Korea want unification. But during this entire period of the 10 years of progressive movement, the new right, as it's called, formed in South Korea. And they made, at the start, what seemed to be completely ridiculous points. They demanded, for instance, at one point, that Kim Dae-jung, the president of South Korea, face criminal charges because he went to North Korea and violated the national security law, which forbids contact on the part of South Koreans with North Korea. So even, you know, the president of the country's public attempt to reconcile differences peacefully was talked about by the new right as a criminal act. Now, 10 years of these progressive administrations were also very good for the economy. Real estate prices just skyrocketed, and, you know, the national per capita income went above $20,000 for the first time. It was a huge step. Along comes the next election. The progressive forces don't have a charismatic leader to run for the election in 2007. What happens in the December 2007 election is that the former mayor of Seoul, Lee Myung-bak, who had been a construction executive, made millions of dollars, and who as mayor of Seoul had done at least two very good things. One was the Cheonggyecheong stream that he uncovered. In place of a highway, he built this had built this wonderful recreational park, water park, right in the middle of Seoul. And secondly, he modernized the bus system of Seoul so that he created bus lanes and color-coded buses that some in neighborhoods. It made it very easy for people to get around. And on the basis of those actions and promises, the 747 promise, he promised that he would, for instance, make Korea the seventh largest economy in the world. They were right around ninth at that time, ninth or tenth, depending on the price of oil. They were, at one point, when the price of oil was really down, they were bigger than Russia, the economy of South Korea. So they, you know, under these progressive administrations, business had been good. The Korean cultural wave saw Korean culture spreading all over the world through television dramas, music, movies. Lee Myung-bak was elected, and of course his promises turned out to be completely false. He didn't, for instance, develop a new economic policy that was able to bring per capita income up to $40,000. In fact, it's gone down below $20,000, below where he started. He didn't adopt a pragmatic sunshine policy, as he promised. He said, I'm going to keep the same basic policy, just be more pragmatic about it. Instead, he has antagonized the North, and the relations have basically been severed, you know, between the North and the South at this point. The tourist resort in the North There was a shooting incident, and it's basically been shut down. The industrial park is facing also a shutdown. So relations have deteriorated, as I said earlier, to the point where people suspect a major or a minor, however you want to look at it, but an engagement in the West Sea, a naval engagement, seems highly likely in the next few months, largely because of the South's insistence on lines that never have been arbitrated, but have simply been asserted by the South, lines in the sea. So the Lee Myung-bak administration in the world constellation, this part of the, what the Sunshine Policy was South Korea moving closer to China and away from Japan. China became South Korea's main trading partner during the time of those progressive administrations. Lee Myung-bak was born in Japan and has met monthly with Japanese Prime Minister Aso. So he has attempted to move Korea closer to Japan. And in doing so, he has really taken on the media here, not the print media, which is fiercely conservative and loyal to Japan, but television media and the Internet. He went after the producers of television shows on South Korea's largest station and replaced the president of three other stations with his own cronies.
And good, we have to break again, and then we'll have a final segment. I'll let you continue when we come back and explain more fully how repressive this government is, cracking down on the media.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. Excuse me. Welcome back to the News Hour. On with George Katsiafikas from South Korea. George, I read your article, South Korea's Rollback of Democracy. It would be an eye-opener to most people who have no idea what's going on there. There's certainly no reports in the media here about South Korea other than what might be business-related, and it just kind of passes as the usual kind of business report. But you make it sound that South Korea, under the present government, is really turning into a very hardline police state.
Yes. In fact, some of the policies of the military dictators have been revived. For instance, instead of conscripts, draftees, being used in the police, riot police forces, the Lee Myung-bak administration has created a new force that will eventually have 14,000 highly trained professional riot police that will shut down any attempt to have protests in the streets. But he's already enacted laws, because not only does the conservative new right control the print media, they also control the South Korean National Assembly or Parliament. So they pass new laws that essentially are able to blame any group that organizes a demonstration for losses claimed by any business. So if there is a protest and business says, well, I lost business that day, the organizers of the protest are held financially liable. So they've already gone after all of the various groups that have any assets to shut them down. They have, for instance, even criminalized people on the Internet who organized a boycott of the major print media because of their bias against any progressive policies. And they took their travel documents away. They shut down protests by comfort women. That is a misnomer for women who were made into sexual slaves by the Japanese Emperor's army during World War II. They sent in riot police against comfort women for protesting in front of the Japanese embassy, even though those regularly scheduled protests have gone on for years. The main protest movement in the last couple of years against Lee Myung-bak was led by high school girls who mobilized against his allowing any U.S. beef products, any and all U.S. beef products, to come into the country without regulation. And, high school girls began the protest. They used Internet, like movie star fan sites, to conduct the first mobilizations. but they led to hundreds of thousands of people going into the streets. In fact, on June 10th of last year, there were millions of South Koreans in the streets. That was the anniversary of the 1987 June uprising, in which the direct presidential elections were won. So, you know, the protest had a very peaceful character. There was a marginalized violence that occurred when riot police would attack and protesters would respond. But generally, these millions of people were extraordinarily peaceful, women with baby carriages, Catholic priests. But Lee Myung-bak government basically said any protest of a political character is illegal. You know, that's when the Catholic priest came in and said, okay, well, this is a religious protest.
George, that music means that we're out of time. It pains me at the end of every program to have to break it off. I hope we can do this again. Asia is, needless to say, an extremely important part of the world, and it simply does not get coverage here in the West, the kind of things that you and I are talking about on air today. As events dictate, I hope you may be up to coming back and doing this again. It's 1 a.m. for you now.
Right, it is.
I'm gonna let you maybe get a cup of warm milk or something, and head off to bed. And it's 11 a.m. in the morning for me in Chicago, so it's a good bit earlier. But my great thanks to you, George, for coming on.